because you don't have to disclose. I think it's a very stray, you know. And your letter from some teacher called alchemists. They're talking about energy and they're probably lobbying me for one thing or another. So I just needed to open the letter to see who's talking to us because we were almost being facilitated without me knowing anything. So Gita will give you, there's nothing really so that people in the energy sector keep in contact with you. And I think our best is that they're better and better. Only half time. I'm waiting for somebody. Or what time is it? I don't think I can hold you down any longer. Just to say to members, we still have to adopt the committee progress. If you can spend time today at the end of the meeting to do that, talk a bit about that and adopt it. The other thing that is of my eye that I want to bring to your attention is I hope you are noticing what is happening in the railway transport sector, the space between Transnet and Trasa. And just to remind you that we have a meeting with them early in the year, and we have another one outstanding, exactly to sort out those issues and in terms of long-term, short-term, medium-term, and long-term plans. And I'm raising this to say that we might need to add to the program that outstanding meeting. I had a discussion with the Chairman of Transport this morning. We will get together at the two cafeteria and have lunch together next Tuesday and then plan a joint meeting to deal with this. Because what the two things and people that suffer more are passengers and the economy. When the spend of this allows to continue. So after the Tuesday meeting, I'll give you speakers.
It's Women's Month. I thought that we should also start by wishing all the women in the meeting today a happy Women's Month, and we hope that it will be Women's Month every day. It's a pity that I'm doing this from the chair. Maybe I'm being chachara. Because actually we should be receiving this from the gentleman in the room.
We were just about to do it.
But gentlemen, we know and hope and
that you are good brothers indeed. You are treating women. We know you are treating women with respect in your life, not only at work, in your family and in society. So we want to thank you for being those kind of brothers for us. Today's meeting,
members, are we correct? I want to start the meeting officially. This one. Lisa, who else are we expecting? But we're not taking any decisions, although we will...
Nana is on his way.
Okay. Yeah. So, members, I suggest that we start with your permission. Okay. All right. Thanks. Today, we are having South African Airways before us. The agenda is before you. Before I welcome them, I would like us to do apologies from members, but I would like to acknowledge the apology from the CEO of SAA, who could not make it and said that she will delegate somebody to lead the delegation today. The leader of the delegation is accompanied by people responsible for the areas of focus that we'll be dealing with today. They will introduce themselves after we have taken the apologies from members. The chairperson of the board had also apologized. Apparently, she's addressing a tourism conference in the U.S., and she would have loved to be here as well, so she's also sending her apologies. This one, can we have members' apologies? Then we will ask members of the committee to introduce themselves. Then we'll ask SAA to introduce their delegation. Apologies, sir.
The woman actually a person had his ankle, she fell.
Chairman.
So they broke her ankle.
Okay. Thanks.
I also bring apologies from Dr. Van Dijk, who is busy. My name is Pieter van Dalen. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee.
I am Kosi Muelo Nongonyana, representing the ANC from OR Tambo in the assembly, member of this committee.
Good morning. My name is Jake Dikwawa. I'm a member of the committee from Azapo.
Good morning. My name is Aubrey Mukwena. I'm a member of the committee representing the ANC.
Good morning. My name is Chris Kolodo. I'm a member of this committee. Thank you.
Oye More. My name is Rose Sonto. President of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Mlidi Nana. I'm a member of this committee.
This is Kolodo.
I've listened to the veterans, two veterans right here before me.
Okay.
They're probably trying to say the ANC.
I will say ANC on your behalf.
No, Chair.
Okay.
Gerard Koornhof, ANC member of the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises.
Okay. I did not introduce myself, my apologies. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee. Today I'm the rose amongst the thorns. Gentlemen, I think we must talk about the composition of our committee. No, I'm joking. You never ever make us feel like we are few women amongst men. We are always colleagues who are treated with respect, so we even don't realize. It's only today when you were introducing yourself that I heard baritone after baritone that it struck me. But
in one term.
Yes, Madam Chair, in the beginning when we started with the Portfolio Committee, then it was decided by the Portfolio Committee that we wouldn't say from which party we are, as we are working in a Portfolio Committee, and we are all from this committee, and not representing a party in this committee. We are committee members. And then you have made a decision on that. So I would just remind you of that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
But there is also freedom of speech and expression. So we kind of, if people feel that they want to say that. But I am at Mr. Nana's case. Which cop are you?
Listen, before SAA introduces themselves, can I check whether you have taken up a career in acting? You look more like Queen Moroka, you know. With a new hairstyle.
You watch TV.
I look like Mom Ruby. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. First of all, just to introduce myself, I'm Sandra Kutsia, executive in the CEO's office. And if I may, just again, on behalf of the CEO, Cesar Mzimela, tender her apology, as the chair has indicated. I'm joined today by, on the far right, Fani Zulu, our head of corporate affairs, and I think very well known to this committee as the general spokesperson of FAA. Next to Fani is Mbo Mangmela, and Mbo is the acting general manager responsible for human resources. To my immediate right is Alison Crooks. Alison is heading procurement and fuel procurement in particular as well. And on my left is Joseph Makoro, who is acting as the chief risk officer. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I'm just thinking of my phone. Let me show that on our phone. I forgot it. Sandra, can you please tell us how you prefer to structure the presentation before us?
Chair, I will be undertaking the presentation itself. The presentation has been prepared with a view to laying the foundation for discussion, questions and answers. My colleagues...
Sorry, Sandra. Chair, we've got two other people around the table that have not been introduced.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Sandra.
Yes, thanks for the sharpness.
I'm Edwin Besser from DPE.
Thank you.
I'm Joachim from Witten from DPE.
Thank you. We tend to forget DPE because they most of the time sit at the back, they hide. We would request you every time when we forget to introduce you to please shout. We don't do this deliberately. Thank you. Thank you. Please proceed, Sandra.
Thank you, Chair. The presentation, as I've indicated, has been prepared to serve as foundation for questions and answers. I will facilitate the presentation for the purposes of fluency, but my colleagues with me today represent the areas of discussion, the subject matter of discussion. So we're available as a team to respond to questions and answers and comments from the committee. So if the committee and chair agrees, what we would like to do is to move through the presentation first and then take questions and answers afterwards. But we're very flexible.
Yes, but let's do time management first. Let's agree on how much time do you need so that we know how much time do we budget for. Welcome, ma'am. Happy Women's Month. Thanks. How much time are we budgeting for? How much time do you need so that we know how much time to budget for questions?
Chair, I estimate we will require about 45 minutes for our presentation.
For all the three items?
Yes.
Okay. No. Members, is it okay with you that we take all the three items one after the other and then note our questions if we have them, except only in areas where you think you are being left behind? You need clarity on the spot, clarity only on the spot. That would be allowed. But the questions, we will put them down and ask them at the end of the overall presentation. Over to you, Sandra.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just as a point of general introduction, the areas of risk management, procurement, and human resource development has been raised and discussed in this committee before, and it is recognized that these are areas that require special attention within our company. And therefore, with the presentation today, what we would like to underscore is that, amongst others, these three areas currently enjoy special focus and attention at the board level, at the executive leadership level, as well as divisional and subsidiary level, in other words, at operational level. Therefore, as a company, and particularly a state-owned enterprise, the FAA team welcomes this opportunity to share with the committee the methodologies that we are deploying at this point in time to improve our performance in these areas, as well as a snapshot of the actions that we're undertaking, and as well as a status and progress report in these areas. I will then start with risk management. And Chair, you'll find that particularly this part of the presentation is very much focused at presenting the committee with an overview of the methodology that we deploy in identifying significant risks, the manner in which these risks are managed and monitored within the company, obviously with the objective to minimize the adverse impact on the operations. Accordingly, I will focus on the governance structures as well as and in particular referring to the roles and responsibilities of the individual levels in the company and committees in the company in relation to risk management, the approach that we take to enterprise risk, our risk management process, and then I will close with concluding remarks as far as this function is concerned. As I've already alluded, Chair, the risk management framework is enjoying particular attention of the board. I think you may be aware of the fact that in particular King 3 places special focus on the importance of risk-based audit and generally speaking integrated risk-based reporting of companies as best practice. And we're very much aware of that, particularly insofar as our ability to be risk alert improves our ability to run an agile company. So not only now, but in future, our ability to deal with our risk profile will be a key performance indicator for ourselves. In particular, Madam Chair, you will note that the enterprise risk management policy and framework, as well as the financial risk management policy, is in accordance with approval by the board. The board in itself has established two committees responsible for risk oversight. The first is the Financial Risk Management and Investment Committee. This committee has a particular focus on financial risk and general risk methodologies. The audit committee, also with a focus on risk, is very much tasked with the control aspects of risk. Are our methodologies control attuned, and to what extent are those controls effective? At the same time, operational committees at ExCo level have been established to address specific areas of risk. These include the Treasury Working Committee, the Financial Risk Subcommittee, Emerging Risks and Crisis Committee, Anti-Fraud Committee, and Compliance Forums. And then at a third-tier management level, the risk methodologies are basically filtered down or cascaded down into day-to-day risk management activities. Just a recap on the Financial Risk Management and Investment Committee, FRIC. It is, as I've indicated, it's particularly tasked with corporate financial and investment accountability and associated risks in terms of management assurance and reporting. By way of example, when we come to the procurement function later on, you will note that prior to a procurement process being embarked on with regards to significant and material transactions, the FRIC committee would assess, consider, and decide or approve whether management can proceed with the process of procurement. In other words, it serves as a gatekeeper in terms of the demand function. Should we proceed to procure? In assessing whether management should proceed to procure, by way of example, the FRIC committee will be considering all aspects of financial and other risks related to that particular transaction. The audit committee, as I've indicated, is focused on particularly control, and insofar as there would be reportable irregularities, the audit committee would be the center point where that would be managed. So if there is any risk of failures in terms of control, the audit committee would be picking that up. The Treasury Working Committee is a working committee, cross-cutting, cross-functional team working committee that is responsible for executing all financial market transactions with reference to primarily currency and commodity markets. So this committee would, for example, be responsible for implementing our hedging policy as far as foreign currency and fuel is concerned. Then there's the Financial Risk Subcommittee. This committee would be responsible for developing the hedging strategy itself and making recommendations to FRIC via EXCO for approval regarding the quarterly review of the hedging strategy. The Emerging Risks and Crisis Committee is focused at business continuity during adverse conditions. And by way of example, this committee, for example, would be tasked with assessing whether the company would possibly face a disruption in terms of its IT support in terms of reservations, ticketing, etc., etc. So it's very much an operational risk committee. If we have significant technical problems or acts of God that may influence our business continuity, this would be tracked by the Emerging Risks Committee. The recent problems at London Heathrow, for example, with the fog blowing over from Scandinavia, would have been one of the areas of concern of this particular committee. Then we have the Anti-Fraud Committee. I think its name itself indicates the role. It's focused at implementing fraud prevention, detection, and response measures, and this would include investigating alleged irregularities, fraudulent, and corrupt activities. We also have various compliance forums. Increasingly, our strategy is to enhance the work of the compliance forums to ensure that our focus is preventative and not ex post facto fixing irregularities. So you will find that the compliance forums serve as a basis to establish awareness with the compliance requirements in terms of legislation and regulations. And in particular, we've established a PFMA forum, which as of late has been extremely active. All the top management has been taken through a PFMA awareness review, and it's filtering through all levels of the company. The same applies to compliance with aviation safety requirements. We're just embarking on a compliance initiative with regard to the new Consumer Protection Act and its implications. And similarly, we've embarked on a Competition Act compliance initiative, and that would be driven by the compliance forum. This, again, is a cross-functional team initiative.
How is the forum constituted?
The forum is constituted of all the key divisions that have an interest in the particular subject matter. For instance, if it's, let me use the example of Consumer Protection Act. The Consumer Protection Act has a very clear customer-facing implication, as well as a supplier implication. So all the relevant divisions would nominate a representative to the forum. That forum would have the responsibility of driving the awareness campaign, identifying the risk and driving the awareness campaign, and they would then liaise with all levels within SAA to ensure that the risks are detected, the risk mitigation initiatives are identified, and that that is communicated to all touch points where this risk may occur. As far as management is concerned, the responsibility to design and implement appropriate risk and compliance management systems vests with management, and this is also this requirement is incorporated in the performance agreements of individual managers. Then, as a check to the effectiveness of our risk management framework, the internal audit function has been enhanced. We have an external service provider assisting us with that, and they do spot checks with regard to the effectiveness of our risk management framework, as well as, for example, in relation to specific functional areas where we know we have a compliance risk, such as procurement. They will do additional spot checks in those areas. So the approach that we've moving away from the structural dimensions, looking at the approach to enterprise risk, the risks are managed at three levels, commensurate with the structural definition. First of all, strategic risks, then divisional, subsidiary or functional risk, and then project risk. Significant risks are determined by using a 5x5 risk matrix, assessment matrix, which is determined with reference to two criteria. The first is probability, and the second is the impact should that risk occur. We've got a template of this 5x5 matrix on the next slide, which I'll discuss with you in a minute. What is important to note is that our risk assessment matrix incorporates both financial and non-financial elements. What we have found in the earlier years of the rolling out the SAA risk management framework was that it was originally very much focused only on financial risk. And we are progressively improving our ability to detect also operational risk and the impact of that operational risk both on business continuity as well as on the financial aspects of the business. Moving to the matrix itself, committee members may wish to note that in terms of each of the columns, we identify the risk in terms of levels or categories ranging from catastrophic to minor, and obviously we will be focusing our attention more on the catastrophic risk. That risk category or risk level is determined with reference to the impact and the highest impact and the highest probability should that occur. Should such an event occur, the outcome description then also defines the severity of that event occurring. Committee members may note that an assessment is also done with regard to a risk event regarding the financial impact, the impact on business interruption or continuity, what the impact of that event would be on the company's reputation, the impact on regulatory or legal non-compliance, the impact on the natural environment and the impact of safety and health, and particularly there we're looking at employees and communities. SIA being a, essentially being a service to people business, we are very much and increasingly conscious of our obligations in the area of safety, health and the environment. We're happy to take decisions in, to take questions in relation to the detail on the slide, but in essence what we wanted to communicate with this slide is the width and depth of the 5x5 matrix in terms of assessing both financial and non-financial considerations in detecting our risk. As far as probability level is concerned, we apply again 5 levels, ranging from almost certain to rare, with a description of what we mean by those levels and an indication of rating. So the ultimate risk rating would be a function of a multiplication of the probability and the impact level. Regarding strategic risk, the process that we follow is that strategic risks are essentially identified, analyzed, and evaluated on an annual basis at the time that we undertake our planning processes to develop our corporate plan. Our risk assessment and mitigation plans are then reflected in our corporate plan for assessment by our shareholder and the National Treasury. For the purposes of developing that risk matrix, we follow both a bottom-up and a top-down methodology. In other words, from an operational level, we will find a build-up of risk matrices from all the divisions. It would be consolidated at EXCO level, and from EXCO level, it would be taken to board for approval and then incorporation in the corporate plan. We report to the shareholder on a quarterly basis regarding any trends in movement and treatment of those risks. That is both to the shareholder and the National Treasury. And ideally where, you know, we try to show that our risk mitigation is effective. In other words, the rating of a particular risk has come down, where we have been unable to secure a downgrading of a risk, or where a risk has increased in its rating, it is our responsibility to alert the shareholder of those growing risks that we have difficulty mitigating and may be ongoing for a while. By and large, the sources of the strategic risks lend themselves to legacy issues at this point in time, as well as the regulatory environment in which we operate. Members of the committee and the chair may wish to note that in relation to all three of the areas of discussion today, SIA is working towards an era where legacy is no longer part of the debate or discussion with, for instance, the portfolio committee or our shareholder. We still have, we have to acknowledge that we've made significant progress in dealing with legacy issues, but there are some, still some residual legacy issues which influences or permeates our risk profile. At a divisional level, where we're dealing with day-to-day operations, the risk management process is obviously focused more on a day-to-day, ongoing basis with the divisional units, and it's facilitated at least at a quarterly basis through a workshop methodology. The workshops are attended by the general managers or CEOs of the subsidiaries and their direct reports. The significant risks are at this level are treated and managed at divisional or subsidiary level. They are, however, reported to the EXCO on a regular basis, as well as the audit committee on a quarterly basis. If a significant risk is not mitigated at divisional level, in other words, it would attract attention at EXCO level, as well as the audit committee, for specific guidance and instructions on how to either enhance the risk mitigation or to find alternative means to mitigate that particular risk. As far as functional risks are concerned, these are, and again, these functional risks in most cases cut across the business, but they're mostly related to compliance issues, and I've already mentioned examples such as the new Consumer Protection Act, which will take effect in October, compliance with antitrust legislation, and hedging issues. The committee may recall that these risks enjoy particular focus from the compliance forum. And then particular project risks are identified at the time that major projects are initiated. By way of example, we could refer to the World Cup. In the case of the World Cup, particular project risks were identified in advance, and the effectiveness of risk mitigation on significant risks were basically tracked on a day-to-day basis and reported to the EXCO. Chair, I have already alluded to the fact that SIA operates in a highly competitive, risky and complex global environment, and therefore our risk management practices should be and is integral to the way in which we manage the business. We have highlighted the fact that we still do have a number of legacy issues to deal with, but that we have accelerated speed in resolving those issues so that we move to a new frame of sustainability without the backlog of legacy. Some of the top risks that are currently being monitored by ourselves and our shareholder include a weak balance sheet, onerous contracts that have been entered into in some cases more than a decade ago, but that are evergreen and that we are trying to renegotiate and exit. Antitrust litigation in various jurisdictions. This litigation emanates from activities some years back. Unfortunately, most of the managers currently in the company weren't around at the time that the alleged transgressions occurred. So it is a difficult environment to manage the legacy antitrust issues. Going forward, our motto is to be compliant but agile. And so we have a prevention focus rather than an ex post facto litigation focus with regard to these matters. And then an ongoing area of risk, which has been very much on the minds of, I think, our customers in general, and I know has enjoyed the attention of this committee, baggage pilferage is a material problem, particularly in South Africa. Chair, that takes care of the risk management presentation. Before I move on to the other part of the presentation, do you want to pause and just check on questions, or shall I continue?
I want to check member clarity questions. Are there any clarity questions? Members, are you still wanting us to proceed?
Mm.
Yeah. So, Dr. Koronov shaking his head?
No, if the majority wants that we can complete the whole presentation, then we can fill in all the questions to the end.
But I saw two hands. It looks like we have two questions, but we were not Dr. Porno.
Which one?
Is it okay, comrade, what's your preference?
I don't know what happens. I wouldn't like to overrule our earlier agreement. Just listen, just proceed.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll note our opinion. Just in terms of time management, Sandra, if you had requested for 5 minutes, it means I assume you would spend 15 minutes on each one of the three areas. But I'm just alerting you that you're beginning to run into the danger of time of your 45 minutes. You kind of overspend a little bit of time on repeating an important issue. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for alerting me to that risk. On procurement, Chair, I will be a little bit briefer, particularly since we've had the benefit of our chairperson briefing the committee on aspects of past irregularities that have been reported through the KPMG report, so I'm not going to revisit that. What I would like to highlight is the fact that our procurement policy and manual and practices is of particularly designed with reference to our obligations under Sections 51 and 55 of the PFMA. And what I would like to highlight is that these two sections essentially call for us to have appropriate systems which are fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and very importantly, cost-effective. So there's a system focus, and then there is a control focus in Section 55, which essentially requires us to ensure that irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure does not occur as a consequence of failures in systems and procedures. So that this is essentially the nub of our procurement focus. Unfortunately, as you are aware, in previous financial years there have been reportable irregularities, and in essence that those irregularities pointed to failures as far as systems and controls are concerned. Therefore, we've embarked on a 3-year plan to re-establish the procurement function at a level which we believe is statutorily compliant and in step with best practice, as well as corresponding to the business requirements of the company. A high degree of our budget is in essence spent to suppliers insofar as it relates to the provisioning of our services. So we are a high procurement environment, and we need to design our procurement system commensurate with the nature of our business. Accordingly, we've designed this action plan with particular reference to matters of governance, people, methods, and practices. We have found that we may have the best policy on paper, but when it comes down to the implementation, either as a consequence of capacity, capability, or lack of controls and accountability, we do have breakdown points, despite the fact that the policy is compliant. We do have breakdown points. So all of those aspects are being addressed as part of this plan of intervention. Again, I'd like to highlight that procurement enjoys a high degree of attention by the board. There are essentially three committees that are focusing on aspects of procurement. The first is the Procurement and Tender Process Committee of the Board. This is a new committee. This committee is focused primarily on ensuring that the processes are in accordance with the statutory prescript. So it's a process committee. That the necessary gatekeeping had been applied, that the necessary mandates were in place, and that there are no fraudulent practices detectable in the procurement process. The FRIC, as I've indicated before, is more focused on the value proposition and the business case that prompts the procurement process. and then the audit committee is focused on the control environment. As far as specific areas of intervention are concerned, the short-term focus of the procurement interventions relate to a review of our procurement policy and procedures, as well as the delegation of authority framework. Members of the committee may recall that the KPMG report highlighted specifically areas of concern related to the delegation of authority. This is being assessed with reference to the total business value chain and addressing areas of gatekeeping and accountability. At the same time, we are embarking on a comprehensive vendor risk profiling. And in this regard, we are...
Because your documents no longer
wrong? Chair, there may be minor tweaks to the document. I think the heading has just changed, Chair. We're embarking on a comprehensive profiling of our vendors so that, and this is also risk-based, so that we have a clear picture of the volume, the value, and the vendor dependency exposure in our procurement cycle. By way of example, if we tend to continuously procure from a particular vendor, questions should come up. If we have a particular high volume procurement with a particular vendor, questions should come up. That in itself does not necessarily mean that there are irregularities, but there are flags that should come up, and there should be controls and checks in relation to that procurement. So we're building a profile of what our procurement looks like, and the soft points where we may have problems in relation to risk. At the same time, we are deploying or redeploying the SAP system for requisitioning so that we have IT support and real-time support in terms of the checks and balances in terms of payment. The SAP system will serve as a very important electronic gatekeeping mechanism to ensure that requisition does not happen in the absence of either a valid contract or purchase order issued with the required mandate. So right down from a policy level to a systems level, we are introducing change to ensure that our procurement process is efficient, cost-effective, but with the necessary controls. In the longer term, we hope to...
Can I ask you, I'm very sure that aspect of vendor dependency and use of assets is not in our test. Can you just mark that that information is missing so that you forward it to us to add as whatever to our document?
Certainly, Chair, we will do so, and Chair is absolutely correct. It was the aspect of vendor profiling and audits were addressed in another part of the presentation, but not with the same crispness, so we changed the wording this morning. Our apologies. We'll ensure that the updated version is sent through to the committee. Our apologies in that regard. With regard to the medium and longer term focus, Chair, whereas our short term focus is to have the policies and the systems and the practices well established and clear, the longer term focus is very much centered around the people, the capability, the culture. And that it will be done through a centre-led procurement function that would have the responsibility of ensuring that what is cascaded down or delegated down to functional level is done so in a consistent fashion. It will have the responsibility of ensuring that the systems deployed are continuously enhanced, that staff are reskilled, and that the visibility that we will establish with the vendor profiling is maintained on a continuous basis. That the demand management is improved increasingly, in other words, the business case is very clear, that we reduce our risk to embark on catalog buying where the operations allow us. In other words, buy something from the shelf that we know doesn't require complex design, because then we know that the room for any fraudulent or corrupt practices is limited. We also intend improving our supplier relationship management in order to be more dynamic, but also to ensure that we minimize our liabilities in relation to future consumer protection litigation. And then we hope to introduce through this evolution a cost reduction, a cost efficiency in the manner in which we procure, and we are targeting a cost reduction of 58 million for the 2010-11 financial year. We trust it's not too ambitious, but we have set ourselves that target and we hope to be achieving that. Likewise, we want to extend that to 73 million in the following year and thereafter. It's attached to quality, Chair, but it's also, it will be influenced by two things. A stricter discipline on the demand side. In other words, unless there's a very clear business case to outsource, we outsource. So a higher degree of discipline on the demand side should see some cost reduction. And the other is the manner in which we procure, particularly reference to improving our tender design and description. In other words, being more precise with what we want to buy and doing a price scoping in advance so that we know that the cost or margins are not inflated. So it's on both sides, demand definition and just the procurement, our due diligence prior to procurement improving. What we have done thus far in achieving these objectives is we have undertaken a review. Alison and her team have been intimately involved with this. We have undertaken a review of tender processes aligned with our policy and manual to ensure that across the company, in all the different divisions and subsidiaries, that there's a clear common understanding regarding the tender procedures, that we identify areas where underlying controls need strengthening, to ensure that there's consistency in the application of these policies, and to highlight areas where the policy requires revision. Our conclusion in relation to particularly the need for revision is that there are particular areas in relation to the procurement manual as well as the delegation of authority that requires improvement for purposes of clarity, and that process is underway. We have also embarked on the application of standard tendered order documentation and checklists for each stage of the tender process. And as I've alluded to earlier, with regard to the risk function, internal audit has a particular focus with regard to procurement risk, and internal audit essentially undertakes a sample check of four tenders at this point in time of significant or material size and or complexity in the procurement and reports to EXCO and the Audit Committee of the Board with regard to that. The further improvement that has been introduced and which is very much an ongoing initiative is to ensure that payments are monitored against valid contracts. And this is primarily focused on prevention of irregular expenditure. The initiative that we're deploying there is a monthly review of the spend by vendor against the contract database, interactions with the accounts payable prior to payment being made, review of all the suppliers to identify those with invalid contracts, and then regularizing the suppliers through the bid adjudication committee within the BIC's mandate. It is important to emphasize that this dimension of the activity very much relates to legacy issues. It is a huge task to regularize failure. No, bid adjudication committee, and that's a management level committee. Of course, in terms of the delegation of authority framework, significant material transactions which requires regularization goes to the board. This is just at management level. Chair, I have touched on most of the aspects with regard to our longer term vision. It is our intent to, as far as possible, ensure that we reach 100% compliance with regard to our procurement procedures during the current financial year or towards the end of the 2011 year. There is a clear resolve at board and management level to work towards a no audit comments and/or qualifications in next year's annual financial statement. We are working hard towards achieving that, and we certainly remain hopeful that we'll be able to do that. It's very much dependent on our ability to resolve legacy issues. I have touched on the center-led procurement excellence. I won't repeat that. I have highlighted the fact that we hope to secure cost savings through improvement in procurement. And finally, very importantly, we are working very hard towards improvement of our broad-based Black economic empowerment rating from its current level of accreditation. And Joseph and Alison have been working with service providers to ensure that that is achieved during this financial year. Just some status reference, Chair, with regard to our BE spend. The committee may wish to note that our BE procurement spend as a percentage of total spend is 43.23%. With regard to and that was for the past financial year, the BE spend to date, i.e. as reported in our quarterly report to the shareholder for the first quarter, is 42.31%, slightly lower than the average for the past financial year, but it's not a significant variance that is troublesome in terms of our ability to maintain or improve on that average during the current financial year.
Thank you.
I'm trying to manage that, Mr. Chair. Chair, on the HR and transformation side, again, I know it sounds repetitive, but I do believe it's very important to underscore this point. This area is also enjoying board attention. Through the Remunerations and Human Development Committee. I'd like to emphasize the fact that in the past, the committee was known as the REMCO, just the Remuneration Committee. The new board has placed particular emphasis on human development, and I wish to bring that to the committee's attention. The focus of the committee then being to attend to the employee value proposition and business case for remuneration and human development processes. Chair, what I would like to highlight on this slide is if you look at the pyramid and the total headcount of the company being 7973, just under 8,000 employees, it is evident that we are a people-focused company. A peer people policy is very much, or should be very much, integral to our company. Not only do we use our staff to provide support services, but our staff is also the front face to our customers. So the attention that we are paying to the HR side is a key area of activity on the company side. Do note the size of the headcount at the lowest level, which is 93% of the workforce, which representing the junior level. That means that 93% of our workforce is represented through a bargaining chamber. The net effect of that is that we are a significantly unionized business. Further analysis of the figures of the headcount, Chair, which we'd like to bring to your attention, is the average age distribution in the company. And you will particularly note that the age groups 26 to 35 and 36 to 45, in other words, from 26 to 45, represents the majority of the company. What you may also wish to note is that only approximately 6% of the workforce is close to retirement age. We believe that this bodes well for the company. If we succeed in our retention strategies, we should be able to be successful in our succession planning as well. We have, at all levels in the company, middle-aged or young people that can actually lead the company into the future. What is important to note, Chair, with regard to the age distribution is also the level distribution. And you will note that with regard to level one, which is management level, there is a fair representation across the ages from 36 upwards, with most of the level one executive level managers essentially being in the age group of 36 to 50. You will note that as far as junior level representation is concerned, there is a high distribution of of junior level positions, again in the age group 25 to 45.
Sandra, which level is middle management?
Middle management chair is level 3. It's level 2 and level 3. In our executive committee, we have both level 1 and level 2 members. Level 3 is head of department level.
Okay, we will talk to that later. It's a bit confusing.
Chair, just to assist with that, if you look at level 3, which is the purple, you will note again yours is not color coded. If I may just go to the front and assist with that. Level 3 is this block, and you will note that that's essentially middle management, and the age distribution is more pronounced in the 26 to 45 year old bracket. So senior management and middle management is mostly represented in this age bracket.
What is the total workforce?
It's just short of 8,000.
Let's go see. Members are ready.
If I was the teachers. Chair, the following slide presents a snapshot of demographic distribution. And I should indicate that the numbers that we are presenting in this presentation on headcount and distribution speaks to the consolidated group numbers. This slide also... Indeed. The reason why SIA Technical is emphasized here is purely because it was a slide that we had to use for that purpose. But these are essentially consolidated figures. What you may wish to note is that 34% of the workforce are BE. BE, in other words, it's African, black, and colored, male.
34%.
27% is African, black, and African is black. It's Asian, black, and colored.
You said
27. So 30.
But your legion death is white. Am I wrong?
No, white male is 30%. White female is 9%. If I could use the group name black for Asian, black, and colored, male is 34%. Black female is 27%.
Okay, first is Sandra. We'll come back.
Okay. Chair, the purpose of this slide is to demonstrate progress against targets. You will note that these targets are the targets in terms of the sector charters, and are also the targets that have been approved by the Department of Labor. You will note also that these targets are to be achieved over a 5-year period. We're in year 2 of that achievement cycle, and therefore our achievement against target is achievement in year two of a five-year cycle. Accordingly, you will note that although we are in the negative in areas such as top management, senior management, and skilled technical and unskilled, that the variance is not, that differential is not significant. The most significant differential you will find is in top management, and that is very much a function of the size of the group. If you will see when you look at the numbers, the shortage of one person in terms of achieving the target represents a 14% underachievement as a consequence of the size of the group. So
that's why when you cluster them like this, it becomes problematic. That's how many things that get needed.
Yeah. So if you go back to that slide, Chair, this, of course, is blind to level. When you look at this slide, it shows the nature of the differential in relation to the different levels or types of skills. But what you should also consider when you look at this slide is not only the bar graph, but the numbers. You will see the numbers in the table itself. By way of example, you will note that in terms of semi-skilled, the gap to the target is -6. But the percentage gap is 0.2%, whereas if you look at top management, the gap to target is -1 in numbers, but in terms of percentage, it represents 14.3%.
Can I say something on that last percent? I want to understand the concept foreign there. Whether it's white, foreign, whether white is synonymous with foreign,
yeah.
What does that mean?
Chair, we have a number of outstations on our international network, so SIA also employs foreigners.
That is not a question. Because for me, a foreigner would be a foreigner, whether the foreigner is black or white. I'm trying to understand the where we say we write it as if white is synonymous with foreign. Why can't you separate that?
Okay, that point is taken.
yeah, that's persistent.
Okay. Chair, the next slide is just a further unpacking of the achievement against target on the previous slide as of July 2010. And you will note that we believe that we have a...
We don't have that or...
Where are we?
I must complain about your document. Why is it not saying two, we run up and down, three, other things are responsible for the other. So I just want to register that complaint about the document quality.
Certainly, Chair, we take note of that. Chair, apologies, Chair, we did change the sequencing of the slides. In order to support the unpacking of, and you will note that most of the slides that follow now give you dimensions of unpacking the results in these first two slides. So the same results here are presented with reference to the different levels. You may recall this is a translation of that earlier bar graph. And we do feel that as far as employment equity is concerned, in the area of middle management, i.e. Level 3, considering the size of the workforce, that our employment equity levels in Level 3 requires attention with reference to the target, and that's why that's encircled. But this gives you a breakdown of the percentages for the different levels. You will note that, Chair, that the highest representation of of BE candidates is at the middle level, the level 3 level in terms of black male. Chair, the further breakdown of the statistics in relation to the top senior and middle management levels is presented in this slide. And again there you will note the the comparison between black, colored and Asian representation. With again black male representation being the highest, black female representation being second highest, and then Asian male followed by Asian female, colored female and colored male representation. That is in terms of the BEE grouping. However, you will note that in terms of the totals at level 3, white males and females are still in the majority.
Sandra, can I ask you something?
Yes.
When you relate that employment equity data as of July 10th, that other one, before that one.
Yes.
Yeah. When you relate it to that one, where we have foreign white.
Yes, Madam Chair.
There is no foreign white in that as a
It would have just been counted as what?
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah. I was trying to track it and I don't even see where its level is. Because when I look at that other slide, there are 800 plus people who are professional that are foreign white. But when you try to track back on this slide, your EPT status as of July 10th, you don't depict that number either on level 2 or 3. So there is a disjuncture. Your figures do not tell you.
You
don't speak to each other in terms of that aspect. But let's proceed.
Madam Chair, that point is noted. I do believe that we have equated foreign with white, and so that number would have included in the count of the white, and not in black, and that is just juncture that which we need to address. Chair, then if I could move on to, in essence, before I move on to measures that we are deploying to ensure that we improve on our employment equity status, if I could perhaps just in summary, again, go back to this slide, because this is these are the results as we report in terms of our statutory obligations in terms of the Employment Equity Act. And if one were to put the slide discrepancies aside and just take an overall average view of performance to date against our 5-year plan, we do believe that our employment equity position is representative of a high degree of performance against target, whereas there are variances in certain areas. Again, keep in mind, this is achievement in year two of a five-year plan. And we just want to leave that with the committee. We will certainly improve on the reconciliation of the numbers. We take note of the comments made. Chair, we, in order to ensure that we are compliant with the Employment Equity Act, we developed the necessary workplace skills plans with the assistance of outside help. We've developed a policy approved by the board, and this is undergoing further revision after further discussions with the Department of Labour. A draft disability policy has been developed. It's currently under consideration by the Executive Committee. We have ensured that there's a clear definition of roles and responsibilities in relation to all of the general managers and other stakeholders with regard to employment equity. The other stakeholders would include our suppliers. We have developed a practice manual to ensure that there's an alignment with the Code of Good Practice on integrating employment equity into HR policies.
You are on great time.
Thank you, Chair. And let me just say that EE Employment Equity is a company-wide initiative being employed as part of our employee relations initiative. I'd like to just, in terms of the last two slides, highlight the fact that both in relation to succession planning and retention, a number of initiatives have been lodged to ensure that talent management is kept alive. This is done in collaboration with tertiary education institutions. I'd like to highlight the fact that our cadet pilot program is still ongoing. And obviously here again, employment equity is a key consideration. We've reflected the numbers there in terms of the demographics of people trained through our cadet pilot program. Particularly through South African Airways Technical, we have established a world-class training facility which accommodates apprenticeships, again on the basis of or informed by our employment equity targets. This training school has been accredited both locally and internationally. And perhaps just again in terms of a summary of the numbers, you will note that again here this was a four-year program. The apprentice intake and the number of people trained during that period. I'd like to again just register with you a point of achievement. You will note that in 2009, at the end of this training cycle, the intake is a bit lower, was reflected as lower, the reason being of the majority of the apprentices actually moved over to fixed term employment with SIA. So that's why we have a reduced number on the last year.
Your apprentice is going into done at SIA Technical.
It's done at SIA Technical. In terms of this insight, 59 of the original intake took up during that period fixed term employment with SIA. So So the tapering down of the number is a measure of success in terms of the number of trainees that have been secured permanent positions with South African Airways. They are still in the training process. The others just completed their training earlier on. So the number of 37 still reflected in the 2009 column are still in the apprenticeship program.
And this means then not new intakes to 06. The only intake was 2006,
so you're tracking down your intake year on year. Your 98
will be those that would have taken in
2017.
So actually, you are not moving in terms of intake.
No, it's a 4-year cycle. We will now take in again at the same level or higher, but we are exiting one cycle and we're moving into a new cycle. So what you see here is now that point where we exiting a previous cycle and now re-entering a new cycle. So that's why that figure is lower.
In summary, we've made significant
progress on the human resources development side. There is still a challenge remaining. We've made progress on the procurement side, both in relation to procurement and risk. We still have some legacy matters that requires resolution, particularly so on the procurement side. We do believe that we have the necessary policies and manuals in place to be compliant. Our key focus now is to ensure that our supporting systems and the human capability in terms of applying the necessary control and accountability would follow suit to ensure that we are compliant, that we are risk alert, agile, and that we are cost effective and efficient.
Thanks. Members, I would like to ask you for a favor. Please switch off, Sandra. Mr. Nana's wife is sick. He has requested to leave. But has he left already?
No,
he
left.
Okay. I have said to him he must leave his question. He didn't leave anything there.
No.
It's okay. Thanks. Let us proceed.
We will ask the risk management questions.
Three. Let me just check the time first. I think maximum of three. You don't have to exhaust the maximum for members. I'll take your names. I'll start on that end, Dr. Koranoff, then come down this way. Mr. Hololo. Mr. Santo, you're still deciding. You'll indicate to me if you want to ask. Mr. Mukwena?
I'll save them, Chairperson.
Okay. Mr. Dikubo? And Mr. Fun?
Darlan.
Like Darlan. And Mentor. Mr. Jeju, whilst you apply your mind also. Dr. Korno?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to Africa for a very informative presentation on three most important aspects on SAA. Three questions. One, your FIC committee, your Financial Risk Committee, and your Audit Committee. I think we should pick it up in your annual report, but can you just inform us, especially with the Financial Risk Management Committee, what is the composition? And are they independent people, like your audit committee? And secondly, what is the frequency of your meetings of your Financial Risk Management Committee? That's my first question. I think you can answer the audit committee as well, but I think you publish it in the annual report, so we can pick it up next month on that one. Secondly, you identified four top risks. Your weak balance sheet, your onerous contracts, your antitrust litigation, and baggage pilferage. I think this committee will be very interested about your solutions towards these top risks. And some way, I'm asking you the question, what are the solutions? If we don't have sufficient time, I suggest, Chairperson, that we do make time to engage SAA on your solutions in addressing these four challenges, because it's crucial challenges coming a long way. And you're correct that we've engaged at least on a number of this as a committee already with SAA, and on your last one also with AXA. And it's a huge challenge, and I would like you to address this committee on the solutions to this one. My last question, what role did your committees on risk management play? Maybe also on the procurement committees, but I don't want to go into the second section. What roles did your committees play regarding the findings and actions by your board regarding the your former CEO? Referring to actions taken and findings. And what is the relationship between your risk management committees, or a little bit maybe if you want to go in the procurement committee, your legacy issues, and the KPMG report? Did it parachute from outside in? What linkage were there? And what proactive steps were taken by board committees specifically with regard to the finding against your former CEO?
Thank you, Mr. Koranov. We'll take Mr. Khololo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also thank the presentation by Sandra. It was very informative, I must say. Let me first start with the question on the risk, on the role, responsibilities. In that, out of all the risk committees that we have in place, which committee is responsible, for instance, on the currency fluctuation? Say, for instance, you have an investment program in place that you want to purchase this and that, and then 2 years down the line, you find that amount that you've put initially has gone up. Which committee is responsible for that? That will be the first one, Chair. The second one is on the procurement of goods.
Not unless it's a risk question. Because we are going to fill procurement questions.
Okay.
You can ask three risk questions.
No, I've got only one, unfortunately.
Okay.
Let me
pump the question. Thank you. Mr. Mkwena.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also add my word of compliment, as my colleagues have indicated, for a very intelligible and comprehensive presentation. Question one. Barring your sequential confusion of pagination and so on, but I think that's a good presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Question one. Do you have any comments with the CAA, Civil Aviation Authority? Because there's a big question of the issue of risk here. When we talk about risk, we cannot talk about risk outside that body that monitors the safety of all aircraft. What is the frequency of your comments with the CAA? Number two, what is the numerical strength of your fleet? Number three, what is the age profile of your fleet? If you would explain that in the context of how many new aircraft you have and what is the lifespan in terms of renewing them and so on and replacing them. And then just model another one, Chairperson, and say it's assumed that is the servicing of your aircraft. Do you outsource it or do you do it internally? In-house, thanks.
The question on how old is your fleet, it's not only a procurement question, it's a risk question also.
Mm.
So it's well placed in that you run the risk of halting your operations or affecting them adversely if you have a very aged fleet. So I did not it's not necessarily a procurement question. It is a risk question. Thanks. Mr. Kubo?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one question for now. I know that you have said something about it, Dr. Kurenov, also on the composition of committees. against the background of SAA being highly unionized and all those things, I'm trying to understand, in all these committees that you have mentioned, what is there any worker representation?
Mr. Van Dalen will be followed by Ms. Ajay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. I would like to ask a question on this risk matrix. Maybe it's just a question of clarity, where you have a minor incident, which they classify minor, which would mean a business interruption of about one day or less. So it can be 10 hours or 24 hours. And then you have at the back of it, it says a near miss or a minor injury. And then you, so it sounds to me, or adverse national public attention sounds quite serious to me already. But then you say it's an event which do not warrant immediate intervention. To me, something like that would warrant immediate attention of whoever it is that that needs to intervene or give it the attention that it needs. It's like, you know, you start at a level higher than what I should be normal. A normal day should be the starting point, and then you would work to a normal day where nothing is wrong. But you start already at something that is quite significant already to me. It would be a day interruption. Then the other questions I wanted to ask is actually a double barrel question. This would be my last. I would only have two questions, but the last one is a double barrel. So no, I just want to tell you that in advance, just how you quiet, you try to... and it's the same issue, the legacy issue and the onerous contracts. Now, legacy issues is something that us, the committee, could help you with. I'm sure if we knew what they were. And then the onerous contracts. You know, the last time we heard somebody say something about the onerous contracts, we found out that people were selling electricity at below cost. Would those contracts be the same, or would it be something that somebody would force you to transport, say, flammable cargo for another 25 years, and you can't get out of these contracts? Or are these contracts also, you know, have secrecy clauses that that we can't know about them? I mean, this is a huge concern for me.
Are you holding a secret file today?
I might go look for one after this. But
you pre-studied it ahead of the meeting.
Madam Chair, those are the two questions I want to, or the two questions I have with the last one, which is the double barrel one. Thank you.
Okay. Is that Jake?
The one is on the audit committee. What is the composition of the audit committee? How independent are they? And how often do they report to the board? That's the one question. The other one is, there's a whole list of different committees, from the financial risk management, audit committee, treasury working committee, financial risk subcommittee, crisis committee, anti-fraud committee, compliance management, internal audit function, and so on. What I would like to know, how often do these committees actually talk to each other, one, or do they work in silos? Who do they report to? Thank you.
Before I ask my question, I just want to pull a few things together. I think that a request by Dr. Kornhoff is valid. I share the same view, and I want us to agree that we need another meeting where we look into solutions, where you present solutions. What also I didn't find in your report is you didn't attach your policies for risk and all these issues. You just tell us there are committees, but we can't juxtapose the role of the committee with the policy that you have put in place. The other issue that Mr. Van Dallin is raising is the issue of the legacy issues. We would like to have an inventory of all what you deem to be a legacy issue. The time span from which it dates, if it dates back 5 years and all those things, the measures in place to address that legacy issue, and the cut-off date for improvement or turnaround for that legacy issue, because there's no way we can continue talking about. So we your legacy issues are all over. We meet them. Today we hear about this, tomorrow we hear. We want you to do an inventory of all the key issues that you think are legacy and give us the plans for addressing them and the cut-off time by means of which time you think they should be addressed.
And the effects that they have on day-to-day.
Yes, and the effects that they have on a day-to-day basis. Your metrics for risk management, both for probability and risk management itself, is an international norm? Has it been benchmarked internationally? How different is it from best performing airlines in the world, and how do they deal with risk management? I have an issue with your other metrics on probability, where you say that your last but one thing from the bottom, you say that it's serious if it warrants hospitalization. Sometimes it might not warrant hospitalization, but it might warrant long-term medical attention that is costly, that you could be liable for. So I wish to, being a person that got injured at somebody's place, that is your colleague working with you. I was hospitalized, but what if I was, sorry to be personal, it's just that I don't think hospitalization should be the only criteria by means of which you gauge that level of seriousness. In some cases, a person could suffer an injury that warrants long-term medical attention. Okay? And then, of your four top risks, I don't know why you don't have information and document management as a risk, because you allude to the fact that because the board is new, management is new, there is a problem of dealing with the legacy issue because those things occur too. So it could signal a problem of information management and document control. So I want to know if that you do not perceive as a risk, and if you do, what are you doing about it? Because in all business, information can be a very risky business, and I don't know why you do not highlight it as a focal point for risk management. My other question related to labor representation in all these committees, but it has been asked. But the one that investigates, how independent is it, and how empowered is it to be able to investigate board members themselves when they are behaving irregularly, or senior management, the issue of independence that Dr. Korenhoff was trying to raise. Because you can have a committee there, but it will deal with all other junior people and other people, but if it cannot, it doesn't have the powers to deal with the bosses, be them at board level or at senior management level, or the CEO himself or herself, whilst he or she is still sitting, not only after they have left. I would like to know the level of independence and the empowerment that is given to that committee to be able to investigate everybody across the board. Thanks.
Thank you. thank you, Chair. I will speak first that I am going to ask my colleagues also to supplement my responses. If I could start with, and there are some questions that were repeated or are related, and I will deal with them in group fashion. First of all, with regard to the composition of the Audit Committee, the Audit Committee comprises independent non-executive directors, and the Audit Committee reports to the Board on a quarterly basis. So as far as the Audit Committee and its independence is concerned, there is no doubt about it, and I could perhaps also just indicate to the committee that the Audit Committee charter has just recently been reviewed to ensure that it is fully aligned with the new Companies Act as well as with King III. We have the benefit of a very well-informed and active chair of our audit committee, very familiar with both the New Companies Act, the auditing profession. He is from the auditing profession himself, as well as with the King III Code. Mr. Satoli, I think you have met. He was present when our chairperson addressed this committee on the KPMG report.
Yes.
So as far as FRIC is concerned, FRIC meets with the same regularity. FRIC is also comprised of non-executive independent directors. What I should indicate is that the CEO and the CFO are in attendance at these meetings, but the majority composition is non-executive independent directors, and the CEO and the CFO are non-voting participants in these meetings. What I would also like to indicate is that the board has also decided with regard to avoiding a silo effect, and I will address the silo effect also with regard to other initiatives, a structural initiative, that the board has also decided that the chairpersons of the different subcommittees of the board will also ex officio sit on the other subcommittees to ensure that, for example, a matter of procurement that was discussed at FRIC and that is discussed at the Procurement and Tender Process Committee has the benefit of the checks and balances between the two. So that mechanism has been created to ensure that there's independence but that there is also a checks and balances between the different committees.
Is there a follow-up? Because I have one.
The question was the frequency of the meetings.
Yes.
Four times a year, twice a year?
As I've indicated, quarterly. At a minimum. And as and when required. We are currently, if I may just indicate, insofar as the new board has launched a number of review processes and corrective action initiatives, our very recent experience has been that these committees actually have been meeting at least twice per quarter in order to ensure that we catch up on all of the legacy issues and that we move to the phase of compliance as quickly as possible. So it's at a minimum on a quarterly basis.
You said it's CEO and who sits in all this?
CFO.
CFO. Because it relates to the financial the financial aspects in both the audit and the FRIC.
Yes, but in terms of independence, it means that the ability to investigate the CEO is limited by her presence in those committees. Can you tell us the mechanism that ensures that the presence of CFO and CEO in those meetings does not limit the ability for them to be probed when they are found wanting?
The CEO, perhaps I should just be precise in terms of language. The CEO and the CFO are in attendance representing management. They're not members of the committee.
No, I'm saying at the time where it becomes necessary, where they become the subject of discussion, they would not be expected to attend.
No, insofar as they're not members of the committee, the audit committee has the right to ask them to excuse themselves, and this happens, in fact. And it's not only in relation to the audit committee, FRIC, it also relates to the remuneration committee and human resources development committee. It's a standard mode of or rule of committee structure and meeting protocol.
Yeah, no, that's what I wanted to hear. Okay, thanks. You may proceed answering other questions.
Can I just check, Joseph, is there anything that you'd like to add on this?
No, I think that's what
it is. If I can then just go to... If I could perhaps just touch on the other aspect of degree to which the different risk committees actually interact, and the extent to the opposite, the extent to which a silo effect is in place. First of all, let me indicate that a number of these committees had already been in place in the company. The CEO, with the support of the board, is undertaking a review to ensure that there is an appropriate alignment and consolidation of functions, that we're not overly fragmented. And one of the areas where she is paying attention is on the risk side. So it is a valid question. However, in most of these committees, there are cross-functional. There is cross-functional representation. So a process of alignment and consolidation to ensure not only that the necessary synergies are established, but that we also optimize time and effort is underway.
Thanks, sir. I just wanted to also just to point out that...
Sorry.
Thanks, sir. I just like to point out as well, Chair, that I think, as Sandra says, there is a process of cross-representation, and I think most of the committees that we spoke to actually feed through to the Chief Risk Officer as sort of the custodian of what is going on in those areas. So there is a point of consolidation at the CRO level as well, through to the CEO and then EXCO, as we indicated.
When we meet on these issues, can you also bring an organogram that shows us who sits where, and that that depicts this cross whatever representation, so that we understand structurally also how these committees relate to one another and who sits where in relation to whom. Thanks.
Chair, if I may just touch on the second point made by Dr. Kurnoff with regard to, actually it was his last point, with regard to the parachuting effect and the relationship between our risk and procurement committees versus the KPMG report. As I've indicated, some of these committees were in existence at the time that the KPMG investigation were conducted and prior to that. Where we are now, we have seen the current board has undertaken a number of initiatives. First of all, to assess the effectiveness of some of these committees in averting the risks that have been reported through the KPMG report. Two, either through a consolidation and alignment of functions, or by reviewing the policies and procedures, or by enhancing the systems and enforcing an accountability to ensure that we don't have a repetition of that. So it's the KPMG investigation was conducted completely independent from these committees. Although people were interviewed, etc., that investigation was conducted completely independent. However, as a consequence of the investigation, a number of initiatives directed at corrective action are being undertaken to improve the control environment.
Dr. Gorman, is your question adequately answered? I
get a feeling it's not. No, not at all. No, what I want to, let me phrase in a different way. You had a number of board committees historically, either in risk or in management. And prior to the KPMG report, what role did these board committees play vis-a-vis the eventual findings and actions by the current board? And in your review process, did you address the weaknesses? Did you address investigation of these committees? Did they fulfill their function? Were they reluctant to fulfill their functions? Did they know about it? Did they report about it? I'm trying to find responsibilities of the board committees vis-a-vis the findings and actions against the former CEO in retrospect. That was my question.
Sandra, if I may chip in, if you may attempt to answer this question. If you don't have the answer, it's a question we want the answer to. And we want it elaborately and extensively. And I think we are not posing it for the first time. It's just that we are posing it in another way. I think you got the question very well, so I'm just saying you have the leeway to, if you don't fully answer it now, we will sit on that question. Thank you, Dr. Coroner, for raising that question.
Chair, if I could indicate, indeed, as well known, the KPMG investigation was conducted independently, and we will ask them to express an opinion on that because they were the investigators. We as management cannot take a view on that because we weren't responsible for the investigation itself. But we will report back and we take a question on board.
Yeah, no, we want the answer from the board. Because the KPMG report created a platform and an opportunity for the board and management to check what worked best and what did not work best. And we know now what went wrong insofar as the CEO is concerned, but we want to know what are the lessons learned, to put it differently, in terms of failures on part of the board during that period. And we will allow you to go back and report. We don't want this answer from KPMG. We want it from the board. That's what I'm trying to say. Thanks.
Chair, indeed, we take your question on board. Let me just indicate that obviously the board would rely on the assessment of KPMG. Chair, the second dimension to that question was to what extent have we learned from all this prompt review, and I believe that has been answered very much so. Obviously, the current board is very conscious of the lessons learned from the past, and this is also the reason why a number of review and corrective action initiatives are underway. By way of example, Fani has kindly provided me with the detail, the statistical detail of board subcommittee meetings during the previous financial year and the current financial year, and we've almost seen a double in terms of the frequency of meetings. So just a signal of the extent to which activity has increased in terms of addressing these legacy issues.
And the expenditure is also doubling in terms of remunerating them for sitting
time. Madam Chair, obviously I will not express an opinion on value for money, but I do believe you will see the results.
So I'm saying we will be watching also how the expenditure.
Indeed, indeed. But yeah. We trust that you will see.
We will, of course, we will gauge that against
indeed.
Results.
Indeed.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, then, just as far as your point and Dr. Kurnoff's point on the top four risks are concerned, we will. The intention today was just to give you a snapshot of the top four risks. Your point, Chair, with regard to information security and documentation preservation is noted. IT support and documentation security is identified as part of our total risk profile from a business continuity point of view, but wasn't reported as one of the top four risks. We would like to at a future date once we've achieved a higher degree of maturity in terms of our risk assessment, and we would like to brief the committee on the top risks as well as our risk mitigation plans. Since baggage pilferage is enjoying a significant amount of attention, I will ask Joseph in a minute or so just to give you some feedback of the practical measures that we are addressing at this point in time. The chair's question regarding our benchmarking.
Can I just ask you to take my questions last?
Okay.
That's why I normally ask them last. Just give priority to the members' questions first.
Certainly, Chair. I was trying to group them, but I'll certainly do so. If I could then perhaps just ask Joseph to speak on the matter of baggage pilferage, and then I will move on to Mr. Hololo's questions.
Thanks, Chair. Probably as well, just to Sandra's point in terms of information risk, Chair, it's an area that I think in the last month or so we have taken specific focus on. So it's something that we are addressing. Thanks, Chair. And then to the baggage, Chair, I think it's important to note that you know, from the time that you hand over your bag through to us, it goes through various stages to a point when it gets to an airplane and gets loaded and that kind of thing. And I think, Chair, it's important to note that, you know, in our investigations, we've picked up that things can go wrong anywhere in that process. So in that respect, what we've done is actually take, you know, we fly international, regional and domestic. We've actually assigned different kind of service providers to monitor that in those sectors. And that also allows us to actually check, to start seeing whether one service provider is actually shortchanging us and then the other service provider is actually doing that. So we can do some sort of comparison in terms of their performance. You know?
Are you traveling the cost? Or are you not traveling the cost?
No, we don't travel the cost. So we're just making sure that it actually also helps in terms of cost benchmarking. Because if one gives you for the same price or double the price, we can always say, you know, next time I'm getting it much cheaper. So it really has an effect of suppliers actually sort of competing against each other in terms of delivering the service and also in relation to the cost. And in that point, Chair, as well, the other issue that we have actually focused on is actually on enforcing this, the penalties in terms of the service level agreements that we are having with these suppliers, you know. So that's another focus area. The other issue that we do in China is actually, you know, normally you would find that suppliers, when you are not with them part time, they actually don't do what they're supposed to be doing. So we have actually just, from SAE's personnel perspective, increased our airside operations to monitor this supplier, also linking back to the penalties and monitoring the service level agreement. Something that we have actually done in the past few months is also, I might just be getting into details which might probably expose some of the actions that we are planning, but I think it's important to know that we have also deployed some sort of surveillance cameras in aircraft halls, because, you know, sometimes it could be that people are actually, instead of taking the bags out, they are actually pickpocketing. So we have now introducing cameras in the hall, and we also have a vehicle that sort of has a zoom that monitors the aircraft as they come through. So that becomes part of a mobile kind of surveillance that we are having. And quite frankly, Chair, we also are now trying to work a little bit better with the crime intelligence and APSA. I think the point was raised that, you know, when you speak to APSA, it says it's SAA. When you speak to SAA, it says it's APSA. So we are actually quite improving in terms of that cooperation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, Mr. Khololo raised the question regarding currency fluctuation and the hedging around that. Which committee is responsible for that? We have two committees. The one is the Financial Risk Subcommittee, who would essentially develop and recommend to the board a hedging strategy, which would apply to either currency or to fuel, to commodities that are price volatile. So the Financial Risk Subcommittee would develop the generic strategy, whereas the Treasury Working Committee would be responsible for the day-to-day risk mitigation in terms of the currency transactions themselves. Then Mr. Mukwena raised questions with regard to, from a risk perspective, with regard to the Civil Aviation Authority and our engagement with them in terms of compliance. In fact, aviation safety and the risk mitigation around aviation safety as such is very much regulated and licensing based. So not only in relation to the CAA, but for example also the Federal Civil Aviation Authority in the U.S. would accredit, by way of example, South African Technical, who is our service provider. It's a subsidiary, but it's our service provider maintaining our aircraft. So we do go through annual licensing requirements with both the CAA and the FCA for our operations, our aircraft, and the maintenance thereof. And we can report that actually over the last licensing cycle, we have improved the number of reportable variances to an absolute minimum, and those were in relation to minor documentary errors. So on the aviation safety side, we really have been maintaining a very good record, and we have a very good engagement report with the CAA.
I'm not satisfied, that's actually the kernel of the matter. But I don't know the regulations that govern the
the installation of the CAE. But I should imagine that the CAE doesn't just come in at the end, like in the case of Nationwide, where an engine fell out and just say, look, you know, we stop you, etc., etc. There should be some commerce in between. They can't just come in at the time of licensing and then to certify the airworthiness of an aeroplane and say, fine, we'll come in with a sledgehammer when your aircraft having problems. There should be, because the duration is too long, it means it's like they're only coming in twice. At the time when they issue their license and at the time when you default and then punitive measures are taken. That's where the risk hiatus exists, Chairperson. I should imagine that you should be proactive, and I don't know who should be proactive, perhaps yourselves, because you see, they've got the higher ground,
higher authority.
It's almost like went to a doctor when they're already on a stretcher instead of just coming for a regular checkup. That type of an analogy, I should imagine, that should be thinking about risk. Risk in committees, etc., that's still fine because that's all in-house. But the external risk relating to these people who are actually superintending your airworthiness, that is actually the biggest of all risk, because it's, you know, it relates to airworthiness. And I should have imagined that you should have, I didn't want to say, this was missing out, but I just feel that there was this paucity in that, in an otherwise good presentation. That part of it was missing.
Can I just follow up? You see, for instance, two examples that I'll give you, Sandra. I want to ask you about external risks that are not of your making, that are of the making of others that are operating with you in the airspace or air environment of doing your business. It's known that there are problems around the George Airport. Your aircraft fly to George Airport. That is a matter of AXA. It's not your problem. There were reports of flying into George in the evening as being highly risky because of the problems around the runway. Now, it would be a risk that your aircraft could face, but it's not of your own making. It is not in your hands. It is it's caused by somebody else. So it's an external risk that you are inheriting that is affecting, that could affect you adversely. Now, you could engage AXA on this issue because AXA run the airports, but you have Civil Aviation Authority. You want to know the relationship. When and how you escalate risk to Civil Aviation Authority. The other example I want to raise, you know, members of parliament, even sophisticated ones, knowing that I got injured in an lift at the airport, everybody says you must sue SAA. And I have to stand on my one foot and educate and say, no, it's not SAA, it's AXA. So for a moment, I was afraid of going anywhere near the airport. You would have lost a client because I strictly fly SAA. So it is a risk of losing clientele that has got nothing to do with you. That has a lot to do with AXA. But at what point do you escalate that to Civil Aviation Authority such matters? Or do you just work with AXA until you don't find any joy? So I hope I have not diluted Mr. Mukwena's question. But I thought I should also piggyback in terms of your relationship with AXA proactively, not only post incident.
Chair, if I may just offer a correction, our licensing conditions are annual. We, for the purposes of getting an air services license, on an annual basis, we have to satisfy an annual airworthiness test as well. And so that's just as far as the regularity of the licensing is concerned. But at the same time, and thank you for raising this specific dimension, we do engage with the CAA on a very proactive basis. We participate with the CAA working committees. in addressing codes of conduct, new regulations, etc., etc., where we have a problem, and the CAA actually conducts spot checks on us as well. So there is a very, very active engagement with the CAA. On the aviation safety side, you know, we're really doing very well. It's more on the operational risks, such as baggage forfeiting, etc., etc., that our maturity levels in terms of risk mitigation has some room for improvement, but it's not that material. Chair, your example related to risks beyond our control. In our risk matrix and our risk treatment plan, we do distinguish between risks that are within our control or beyond our control in relation to determine the probability of that occurring. Because if it's within our control, we control to a far greater extent, we can predict whether that probability would occur or not to a far greater extent than when it's beyond our control. So all of those dimensions are considered in the risk matrix. So just as far as that particular question is concerned, if I may then just speak to Mr. Mokoena's issue on the fleet. We have we are going through a fleet renewal initiative. I think the committee is aware of the fact that we are continuing with the Airbus purchase. That purchase is an envelope of 20 aircraft to be delivered over a period stretching approximately 6-7 years. And the fleet renewal is required for a number of reasons, age of aircraft, and particularly the age of aircraft is not only a consideration with regard to safety, but very much cost efficiency. The new fleet that we're bringing in should allow us to run certain routes on a far more cost-efficient basis, and also allows more flexibility of switching aircraft between routes. So our fleet utilization would also be far more cost-efficient. In the interim, we are undertaking short-term leases just to fill the gap between the outgoing aircraft, current demand, and the date that the new aircraft are coming in. So yes, our fleet is increasingly aging, but we have a fleet replacement plan in place, which has been approved by our shareholder in our corporate plan. We are also not going on a massive drive of acquisition of new aircraft. What we are doing is we are improving our, as I said, our flexibility in both fleet utilization as well as cost efficiency, so that our focus for now on a sustainability drive is in essence fleet replacement rather than a significant expansion of fleet.
When your figures of fleet replacement and fleet leasing, can you talk to that? The proportion, because we want to know percentage-wise, what is your percentage of ownership? What are your plans going forward? Maybe we are dealing with procurement already, so I don't know if I'm jumping the gun, but your fleet planning could be a risk if you don't study properly. But you have not spoken to the figures of ownership, planned ownership, leasing, etc.
Yes, and Chairperson, good. I was interested, Sabila, I understand the futuristic plan, that's fine. But what is the current numerical strength? Mm-hmm. What's your fleet now? Mm-hmm. How many aircraft do you currently have?
And how many are within the, how many are phasing out, how many are still going for a longer time in terms of nautical miles they've traveled, their age?
Chair, I think your questions are going far beyond risk now, if I may say. So what I would like to suggest is that we actually come and present to you our fleet replacement plan. I will still respond to aspects of your question in a minute, but I think you should also just bear with us that we came here to present to you a snapshot of our methodologies and actions and not go into the detail. But insofar, if I could answer your question with reference to the framework of our current corporate plan, which is a 3-year time frame. Within this time frame...
Mr. Mugwen and Mr. Kholulo would like to say something. I'll allow them so that you respond comprehensively, but we note the point that we might need to come back and discuss fleet plan. In fact, the idea of putting procurement plans here was essentially to deal with that. So we'll touch on it when we deal with the questions on procurement, but we do agree that we need a meeting. In fact, DTI is also very interested in that aspect of fleet planning for all SOEs for purposes of localization, skills transfer, etc., etc. So let me hear them out so that your response covers what they might be wanting to say.
Oh, thank you very much. Just on that one, on the fleet, actually, I wanted to ask that question earlier on, because previously, with the previous CEO, Kaya Nguler, he told us in this committee about replacing the fleet. He spoke about the 747, that they were grounding all those aircraft. And I think 2 weeks ago, I was flying to my hometown, Mpumalanga. I saw one of these 747s flying, and I could not understand because they told us that they were grounded. So I just wanted to get clarity about that one as well. Thank you.
Yes, Chairman, you see the significance of knowing the current numerical strength is also, the chart also hinges on risk, because you see, if you have few aircraft, you know, with a big passenger load, then it means the aircraft will have to run up and down, you know, to satisfy that, and that's where the wear and tear is going to be very, very high, etc., etc., and that impacts on the airworthiness, etc., etc., and, you know, the problem that nation has, because ultimately the commission experience. So it's very important, actually, no, if we ask, if you were Transnet, and we ask Transnet, how many coaches do you have? They wouldn't tell us about the future plan. They'll say, these are the future plan, but the actual number of vehicles. How many coaches do they have? 7,000, 10,000, 15,000.
And how many are in good shape?
Exactly. So, and because it's that, yeah, and also the aging factor, so, and the longevity, all those things are very important, you know. So I should imagine that I agree with you, Chairperson, we must not raise vision on this one. We are not raising a note, but would like to have that, yeah. And by the way, Chairperson, quickly, in that Stellenbosch workshop we had, a winter school, we did recognize
that.
That's, I think that's May.
Yeah,
just before the rising of the parliament, second term. We recognize the fact that there are too many issues on aviation, and that was important, because SX Press also there, that you should have a workshop on this whole question of aviation. Help bring the two together, SA and SX Express, and have a comprehensive thing. So, because we are aware that a meeting like this will not suffice to address all the issues.
Sorry, FM, I was ambushed. So, if you are not ready, it's okay, we'll meet again next time on
Chin, I can. I still do believe that a number of the points of detail regarding the age of the fleet and exactly how many we have on lease and how many, most of them are currently either on operating or financial lease, but those exact numbers we will have to come back to you. But I can indicate you, as I've suggested, over the corporate plan period, we're currently at 54 aircraft. We are in the process of adding two wide-bodied aircraft right now, which would take us up to five. Over the three-year planning horizon, we will be going up to 58 aircraft. But the detailed breakdown of exactly aircraft type, exact age per category, etc., I cannot give you today, but that we will certainly give you at the next stage. And I think you will then see the detail behind the fleet replacement plan. Mr. McQuinnah's question with regard to the 747s. The 747s were grounded. Some of them were... Mr. Khololo. The 747s were grounded. Two of them had been deployed just for special projects now, but they are exiting the fleet. That you're just aware of that. It's part of the exiting program, and they have different dates for their final B checks to return to the lessor. So that plan hasn't changed.
I'm going to look for a letter in your CEO magazines that are in flight that's written by somebody that flies South Africa, Nigeria, that's complaining about that aircraft. And a link to that, I'll write you a letter that's asking, is the worst saved for Africa, for the continent? Because that's what came to my mind when I read that letter. If you go, I'll just go, it's not so old an edition that I read in flight. So you'll have to also tell us about when you ground them, are you grounding them and taking them to obscurity in the African continent in terms of that letter?
No, on a positive note, inform you that on the Lagos route, we are getting new Airbus aircraft in to service, by way of example, the Lagos route. So our product in terms of fleet on the Lagos route will change, definitely. So thank you. If you do find that article, we're happy to be reminded of that. But I can advise you that the product is changing on the Lagos route. Yeah.
Chair,
I could perhaps then go to Ms. Nkobo's question. You raised the question around the board committees, and I trust that we've answered that. But then there was also the question regarding worker representation. At this point in time, there is no formalized worker representation on the board as such, or necessarily at the executive committees. However, and I would like Fani perhaps just to add to this, our current CEO is very much focused on the reality that people in our business and the people we serve as a consequence of our business are of significant importance to our ability to take this company to a sustainable path. And so she has been meeting on a very regular basis with Labour to ensure that there's a sharing of information from the executive leadership side as well as Labour side, and that key issues are addressed, and that they are regular report back to Labour. So there's a very key initiative driven from the CEO herself to improve the engagement with Labour. I don't know, Fani, would you like to add?
Chair, not much, except to confirm that indeed the issue of the relationship between management and Labour is top on the agenda of the current chief executive. It is at a number of levels. Firstly, it is about clearing any of the legacy issues. There are a number of concerns, issues raised by Labour, which require the attention of management, which has to be resolved and closed. There is a concerted effort to do exactly that. In terms of the KPMG report, you would be aware that it started with Labour. KPMG investigation started with Labour. That process is now closed in that we have reported back to Labour, and Labour is pleased with the fact that, you know, there's action taken and so on. So that's one big elephant in the room that we've now dealt with. There are several other issues that we're dealing with in that same manner, where we clear all of the legacy issues in terms of, you know, the labor and management. There is secondly the question of having regular strategic discussions with labor on the future direction of the airline. And that we are structuring a quarterly meeting between the various representatives of labor to make sure that, you know, at the leadership level, labor is aware of the direction that the airline is heading and can contribute, can interrogate, can participate in that future direction. But then there's the issue of finally at an operational level where you've got various structures that deal with matters relating to terms and conditions of employment, but also matters relating to shop floor issues such as, you know, projects that are happening in the respective parts of the business. So it is a very comprehensive approach taken by the chief executive to enhance and strengthen the relationship with labor. Thank you, Chair.
Is the relationship regulated by policy or, because if you find a new CEO tomorrow who's anti-labor, that will fall flat, not unless that's regulated.
It's not regulated. It is an initiative of the chief executive realizing the importance that labor plays in running the organization. Some of the you know, actions taken will end up, you know, being embedded in the structures of the organization. For example, I mentioned a strategic session with labor every once a quarter. There is no specific requirement to have that, but we can embed it in the structures of the organization and the annual calendar of meetings within the organization to make sure that there is continuity of those types of interventions. I take your point in, you know, the difference in the approach from one chief executive to the other and not lose the momentum when we shift from one chief executive to the other. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I believe I'm working towards the final question. If I could perhaps just first of all deal with the matter raised by both Mr. van Dalen and yourself regarding feedback to this committee regarding the legacy contracts. We take note of that. Obviously at the time that we've completed our audit and we can actually provide you with that profiling, we'd be happy to share that with you and any assistance that the committee, of course, can render would be helpful. Chair, your question with regard to benchmarking of our risk management framework, and a number of questions were raised by, or comments were actually offered by yourself and Mr. van Dalen with regard to the detail in the 525 matrix. Again, keep in mind that we're talking about risks that are inherent in the business but at different levels of the business. So in some of the examples used would not be reflected necessarily as a strategic risk but would be reflected in the operational risk matrix of a specific business division. And then the interpretation of probability and impact would be different. So what we've shared with you is really the broad cut, let's call it the cookie cutter matrix. But the application of that in relation to strategic, operational, and business unit risk would be different. But when we return with a more detailed exposition as to the different risks and our risk treatment plans, we can share with you the nature of the content of risks at the different levels. But your point is noted, and I don't think it's worth debate. What I would like to mention is that we are actually now embarking on a process of benchmarking our generic model with other airlines from a best practice point of view. And hopefully when we report back to this committee, we will be in a position to share our experiences as far as that is concerned. And the reason why we are going through that benchmarking initiative is particularly because we want to improve on the maturity of the operational type risks that we believe requires attention. Chair, unless I've missed something, I do think I've covered everything. Perhaps just in closing, what I have noted down, sorry, Giles, I'll check in a minute. What I've noted down is that the committee has asked us to, at an appropriate time, brief you on our fleet plan and with various aspects of detail on matters of risk, broad spectrum, but including aviation safety. We've noted the matter of the legacy contracts that we have to report back to the committee. Okay, there was a question, sorry, if I could just go back to one question that I did not answer, Chair. The question was, how independent is the investigations undertaken in relation to reportable irregularities? First of all, our internal audit function has been outsourced to one of the top five auditing firms, and we take comfort in that. These firms don't, we don't instruct them as to which tenders they should investigate for the purposes of their spot checks. They basically just check the procurement register and they apply their own judgment. So it's a totally independent selection for the purposes of sample checking. They report directly.
It's randomly done.
It's randomly done, but obviously in relation to consideration of complexity and value, etc. And they report directly to the audit committee. Where they do pick up minor irregularities or have suggestions on improvement of projects, they will engage with the executive committee, but they don't report to the report directly to the audit committee with regard to those functions. So it's totally independent.
I want to check with members if all their questions were answered. Then we cross over to procurement and from procurement and human resource and transformation. We will take two questions only per member, and I have a gut feeling we will need to discuss them. Human resource development and transformation again when we meet for risk and for fleet planning. But members, I saw two hands, Mr. Fandale and Mr. Mokwena, and Mr. Korenhoff and Mr.
Yes, Madam Chair, I was talking about legacy issues and then the onerous contracts. Is that one thing, or I thought it was two distinct things that you had in your presentation? So if the legacy issue is the one you are coming back to us, then there's still the onerous contract one. You know, what did it mean? Does it mean that you transport BOMB? I don't want to say the name because I'll get arrested on aeroplanes. So I just want to know, does people force you to cargo these things, or do they force you to give by contract cheaper rates for special clients? Or that's what I want to know. And if that is a legacy issue or it's one, then that's fine. Otherwise, I would like an answer on it. Or I would like the report back to be on the legacy issues and the onerous contracts. Or are they secret? That was the question.
Mr. Mokwena and Mr. Korenhoff. Mr. Mokwena, Mr. Sonto, Mr. Dr. Korenhoff.
No, Chairperson, I yield for now. I yield for now, Chairperson.
Mr. Sonto?
Are we on procurement, sir?
Not yet.
Oh.
I just want to make sure I understand Advocate Kutsia correctly. She summarized at the end issues that they need to come back to the committee. And is that correct? And I missed two things. One was we asked clearly for action plans on the top risks.
Mm-hmm.
Policies, procedures, processes. The, on the four top risks, action plans, how are you going to address that? I missed that from your summary. I think we should add it. And then
and the fifth one, so it's five profile, information and document management.
And then we had a specific question regarding the roles and responsibilities of former board committees vis-a-vis the whole saga around the former CEO.
Yes.
What, and I missed that in the summary.
Yes.
So I just want to, don't let it fall off the table. We need it because we asked it in the previous meeting and we're repeating it now in this meeting.
Thank you, Dr. Kornoff. Sandra, you got all those things. We will be writing to you again just to send the checklist in the next 5-14 days. We'll be writing to you to remind you of, and we will plot possible dates. We'll play with dates. We're crossing over to procurement members. Because of time constraints, can we ask maximum of two? You don't have to exhaust the two on procurement.
Not unless we say you ask three and you can shuttle between, if you will manage, between procurement. Is it possible? Between procurement and human resources.
Mm.
Then you take
two.
Okay. Let's do that. That is my mind operating in a side of this moment. I'll start from this side of the table this time around and take your name. Mr. Van Dalen. Mr. Kumo. Mr. Mokwena. Mr. Tonto. Who's that? Olola. Sorry. Sorry, Mr. Kumo. Mr. Tonto. Yes.
Yes, I wanted to ask under the procurement, I don't have anything for the other section, is I have two questions, and that is, you know, what policies have you got in place to make sure that which you need to procure internationally at the moment, you can't procure in South Africa? You know, because it might be part of a legacy contract or an onerous contract that you have to buy certain things overseas to be able to get a cheaper rate or to put a bestelling in for like 10 Boeings, then you have to buy spares from a certain place and you can actually get it in South Africa, but the contract forces you to buy it overseas. So what have you got in place to make sure that you buy the maximum from SA, because you are the national carrier? I would assume that you are also, proudly South African. And that's why I would like to ask why, what have you got in place to make sure that you procure these things from South Africa and not just overseas, because it's cheaper or easier or sometimes part of contracts. And then the BE targets, do you also find that in your company you have, with targeting specific BE outcomes, you get people that quote for something, they can't do the job. I mean, in the municipality, we have lots of these examples where big machines are standing still because they can't buy a 100 rand part because the procurement makes it difficult to buy. It's there in the procurement, but the people that have to buy and procure through that system don't understand it properly. So then for 6 months, a machine would stand still because you can't procure a small, little, teeny-weeny part for 100 rand, and the whole business stands still in a certain sector. And then obviously the part where you get service providers that can't do the job. What is your policy in that regard? Do they get one chance, and then if they don't perform, you take them off the database or whatever it is you procure them from?
Thank you, ma'am. It's on HR. Maybe just to that issue of foreign stroke white, just to put beyond doubt, is it correct that all foreign employees are white? The other thing, I just want to understand the rationale in their headcount, because we are told we have 7973 employees, and then we come and say excluding 500 fixed term, 1181 temporary. Why do we exclude them? Does it have something to do with their level of benefits as employees? because I thought you'd have just added the numbers and said, by the these are the permanent ones, these are the fixed term ones, these are temporary ones. Why do we say 7973? We exclude 1,000, we exclude 500.
Colleague here, we talk about as foreign white employees. Do we have any foreign black employees?
Any follow-up to this question?
Can I note that you have 865 professional qualified foreign / white. Now, you've been in existence for more than 75 years. Earlier on, we asked you how big is your total numbers of employees. We said around 8,000. Now, it means 10% of your cream, de la cream, which is professional and qualified, is foreign and white. That says something about your training. So can you just talk to that? Why is that figure like that? And what are you doing to correct it? It's actually a very shocking figure. If you have a total 8,000 of personnel and 865 is foreign and white and they are professional and qualified, it's a reflection on you in terms of your training, your personnel, your recruitment right from the beginning, and now you take people up through the echelons of your company. That was a follow-up. The next person will be Mr. Mokoena on his own independent question.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. The Honorable Ajay has just taken the wind out of my sails. All right. The first question is, it's linked to what I've already asked the question before, but I think it was in the wrong category of the servicing of your aircraft, of your fleet. Do you do it in-house or you outsource that? That's number one. Number two is, relating to procurement, again, your procurement beneficiaries, do you have a strategy? Are they sustainable or is it just a one-off thing? Once a thing, and then after that, the person just goes away, and there's no sustainability, or is that a mechanism? Imagine yourself, to which you'd like to keep them without excluding new entrants, but to ensure that you take them from level one to level two, level three, so that they can grow in capacity and in turn help us to absorb more people and create more jobs. Because it's one thing to give out the tender for 6 months, and then from this gone. And then that person then falls outside that economic activity. And with the new person coming, then it's just a vicious cycle, and then it has a series of failures of procurement beneficiaries. Whereas there should be a strategy to say, we're taking this person here, and without monopolizing, but to ensure that the person goes into the procurement dispensation for a reasonable period to gather skills and to net other people so that we can produce. People. That links up to what the chapter was saying in terms of how many people do you actually, can you actually say in terms of the truck drivers since we came to being as SAA, so many people have actually been produced so they can exit the system and then, you know, become independent as job creators.
Thank you
very much, Chair. Mine actually will be only three questions. One would be on the apprentice program. That since you employ these white foreign employees, I'll assume also that they will be black also, because there are these regional airlines that you go to, like Zambia, Kinshasa, and so on. So that my question around that will be, whether do you also train them? Are they also in part of your program, of your apprenticeship? That will be the first one. And then the second one would be on the procurement, in that I see that there was a decrease of 42.31% BEE procurement. That was for 2010, and then previously in 2009 there was 43.23%. My question is why this decrease actually? Because I would expect that this number should go up every year. That is the second one. The third one, the last one, you know, since 1994 actually, we've been talking about empowering women, people with disabilities and so on. The problem that I see now is that on your report here, you say that the disability policy draft has been completed this year. Why did it take you so long, actually? Because it's how many years down the line? It's about 18 years now. And there's so many people with disabilities who are unemployed. And I think you need to do something about this, you know, speedily. So that will be my last question. And then, of course, the human resource one, your relationship with the unions, I think you wanted to that one. Because I wanted to know what is your relationship with the trade unions. I heard you mention that. No, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Let me start on human resources. Why do you have such a big number of casuals? More than 1,000. I think it's something that I need clarity on. Secondly, on the procurement, I'm looking worried at your project. There's a cleanup project that you have set up. For how long are you going to be having that project? Because when you go to progress to date, it practically means that there's a lot that this project is doing there, and one would be interested to understand the prevalence of this practice that is depicted here. Invalid contracts and all that kind of debt that this project is doing, is dealing with. One would just be interested to know how long is this project going to be and how prevalent the practice that it is dealing with is within the essay. I was also interested in that variance. Hululu told me that 42-43% BEE procurement, but Hululu has taken that from me. I think those are the two.
Too much to ask.
There's two questions. The one is in terms of we have an excellent training score.
And we've seen it. And we are very proud of it. Now my question is in terms of our agreements with the SADC region, our region, do we actually assist in training personnel in from the SADC region? Because it is part and parcel of what the state has decided in terms of the agreement within SADC. That's the one thing. The other thing is that in terms of skills training, I mean the kinds of skills training that is given at your schools that we have seen, how does, have you re-looked or looked at how you're going to actually accommodate an increase in training in terms of our new industrial policy? Because there are skills there that you can provide, which goes across not just only for civil aviation, but across other sectors of the economy as well. Because I think that if we are talking of a developmental state, we're going to have to use every resource we have. Because one of the things, as we all know, which is lacking in this country is skills. Have you got any plans to actually enlarge your training capability?
Dr. Kuro, you still don't want to take it?
No, fine.
Okay, thank you. Just to map firstly the things we said we'll talk about when we come back, and DTI will be in attendance when we deal with procurement, medium-term, long-term, fleet planning in particular. They are concerned, like we are concerned in terms of fleet planning, on issues of localization, which is local content, which is a key issue in industrial policy action plan too, as well as the issue of skills transfer. Do you procure the vendor dependency that you spoke of without creating an environment when you procure that I will procure this amount of fleet from you. As I procure from you, you will assist me to set up industry to begin to buy locally, but you will also assist me to develop the skill that would be able to sustain that industry once it becomes localized. The other issue that DTI is equally concerned, and in fact I've been talking to Mr. Zalk, I've not briefed the committee yet about these issues, and the chairperson of DTI. The other issue of SME. You just SOEs will just report on BEE and BBBE, but they will never tell us about the initiative to building the and sustaining SME development in the country. Also as a point in IPEP 2. Now my questions. Do you procure from other SOEs? If not, what prohibits you from doing that? Is it the regulatory framework? Is it poor service? Is it the historic silo approach? I'm raising this question bearing in mind the turf wars between PASA and Transnet right now. When we visited them in November, Transnet, they said PASA is not ordering services, locomotives, etc. We do not have the benefit of asking PRASA why don't they, and then since then this thing has exploded. It has affected passengers, just it's affecting the economy. Now we want to know, is it quality issues, is it legislative issues, is it regulatory issues that prohibits you from getting services from other SOEs. Sometimes I sit in an aircraft and listen to the, and SAA will forgive me, the shoddy voice system, you know, announcement system. For me, it's not technically savvy how the voice speeches and all those things. And yet I know that Transnet's engineering school can do that. In fact, we asked them when we met them, can't you do something about the technical, I don't know system, I don't have a technical name for it, but your sound system through which you do announcement and all,
the quality of sound. Sometimes it's shrieky, sometimes it's, but when you fly other airlines internationally, maybe connecting, you find that the sound technicality or sound quality is better. We suggest that the equipment is better or is better service or whatever. It's one service that you could procure from. So I want to know what prevents you from doing so. The other issue, the regulatory environment around procurement. How prohibitive do you find it to grow your business and to assist you to play your meaningful role in growing the economy? My last observation, your headcount age distribution, it's terrible. You have 270 18 to 25 people, 26 to 35 is 2000. Your personnel is very aged, seriously so. 50 and above amounts to more, close on 30%. If you read from the margin of 46 to 50, if you add that 795, it's 2,200 of 8,000. And if you go to the other extreme of the age distribution, you're 18 to 25, which means you are not actively recruiting young people, and yet you know that we are sitting on a time bomb in terms of lack of employment of young people in South Africa, youth employment. So that is just the one thing that I want to bring to your attention and to tease you on your recruitment strategy, and what are you doing to deal with your aged personnel. You still have 96 people that are plus, that are 60 and plus. If I add those last two, it's 442 and 96, and it's highly risky. Those people can exit at any time. They can even take early severance packages, or they will sit there. So I don't see from your distribution an active intention to augment. If there is a plan, tell us about it. If you can't elaborate on it today, when you come back, you will do so. Thanks.
Sorry,
sir. Yes, sir.
Just the last one on the sound on the aeroplane. You know, when they give this safety announcement to the passengers, actually, there are those who cannot hear. If they are having any plan, for instance, of those who cannot see, who cannot hear, as to what is it that they should do in case of an emergency in an aeroplane. If there are any plans, maybe to try and teach some of the, what you call, of the those who work in the
cabin crew,
to know one extra language, of maybe sign language, just to alert those passengers who are having those impediments. Thank you.
Can I give you positive feedback without diluting what Mr. Singh said? I've been disabled for the last 2 months. I must commend SAA about how you train your personnel to deal with people with disability when they ask. It's called, I've been using passenger PAU, PAV, yeah, assistant service, yes. I really want to commend you for your excellent service, wherever I travel. And I said to Loretta, for these two months, when you book me economy, don't say who I am, just book me as a person needing PAV. And I was treated every time with dignity and with excellence. You might need to have that feedback. Thanks.
Chair, if I start, first of all, noted the comments of detail with regard to the risk plans and the legacy issues and onerous contracts. Obviously, some of these matters have been referred to as generically, but we note the points of detail that you want covered under that, and we'll ensure that that be done. With regard to Mr. van Dalen's questions regarding procurement, perhaps just a number of initial comments. First of all, keep in mind that South African Airways is slightly different to Eskom and Transnet in terms of the difference in industry that we operate in. One of the key differences is the competitive space. We're in a very competitive environment. When we purchase aircraft, we compete with, you know, on purchase price with Comair Kalula, who has the link with the British Airways franchise, etc. So our procurement environment is different to that of a Transnet and an Eskom, both in relation to the type of industry. We're a service-orientated company versus an infrastructure-orientated company, at least in terms of primary focus. And moreover, the competitive space is significantly different. However, that doesn't mean to say that buying South African is not a priority with us. In fact, buying South African is very much a priority with us. But when we do purchase aircraft, obviously that would be an international tender. There would be just so many companies that you'd be able to buy the aircraft from, unless you enter into leases. But when we enter into short-term operating leases, quite often we lease from local companies. However, what I would like to emphasize is that, and we have, our suppliers have been compliant with the National Industrial Participation Program, but I should also indicate that the requirement of the NIP does impose some restriction on our ability as to whom we can buy from, because not all our suppliers are in a position to satisfy the offset requirements. So it narrows down our supplier base. Secondly, it is common knowledge that the NIP is factored into the price. The cost of compliance with the NIP is factored into the price. As a consequence, and you know, averages have been mentioned, but as a consequence, it is rumored that on average we would pay between 3 to 5% more for an aircraft than our competitors would, just because we are subject to NIB obligations. But certainly our procurement policy is directed towards buying South African, and a lot of our supplier requirements, other than the big fleet requirements that we can only procure internationally, are actually South African. So when we return with our audit on the spend, we can also share with you the exact quantums or percentages with regard to that. What I would like to highlight is that a number of our suppliers, especially in the smaller stations, are SMMEs. As far as possible, we try to encourage a continued but competitive relationship with smaller suppliers to enable an embryonic environment in which they can grow their businesses. So we are conscious of that. The question as to whether we don't have a concern that those suppliers won't be able to deliver, one of the key initiatives that I know that Alison has launched is to improve on the due diligence of suppliers. So we would be doing in advance not only a financial but also a capability due diligence. In the past, this function was a bit weak, but as of late, it's improved and our due diligence is done more regularly as far as that is concerned. With regard to the question, the detailed question on the foreign white discrepancy, I am going to ask Mbo to speak to that. Insofar as I recognize the discrepancy, but unfortunately I personally cannot give you a clarification on that. I don't know if Mbo can do so, otherwise we'll have to get back to you. But I can confirm that we do also employ foreign, black foreign individuals. So that I can confirm. With regard to the headcount and the exclusions to the headcount, let me indicate that for the purposes of our reporting, we've included in the definition of headcount those people that are in permanent employment with the company. Fixed-term employment would be on average for a period of 5 years. The benefits aren't materially different other than the fact that there's a fixed term to the employment relationship. It's interesting that the point or the size of the labour force that are temporary was raised because we would like to inform the committee that the company has recently adopted a policy whereby we are phasing out the temporary employment and actually transferring those people to either permanent or fixed-term contracts to give a longer range of security of employment to those people. To the extent that in future we would, our plan is to only use temporary staff for purposes of seasonal demand as well as special projects. Now, an example of a special project would be, for instance, the World Cup, where we have peak demand or a high demand for certain types of services, we would then buy in temporary labour. So the intention is to actually switch those into the headcount.
Just for interest sake, Chairperson, what are they doing actually or normally?
These would be people deployed across the company and in different subsidiaries, but it would primarily be on the services side where we do face peaks and seasonal flows in terms of support demand. But it's across business. It would be in cargo, it would be in technical, it would be in operations. It's really across business.
Then
as far as the servicing of the aircraft is concerned, our aircraft are primarily serviced by South African Technical, which is a subsidiary of the SIA group. Then there were a number of questions related to SIA Technical, in particular with regard to the training capacity and the extent to which that is being deployed within or available to the SADC region, but also available in support of the National Industrial Policy. I would like to report that at this point in time we are investigating various possibilities in establishing South African Airways Technical as a regional MRO or maintenance and rehabilitation hub, and insofar as the training school is attached to that, that would form part of that strategy. And the focus is really just what is the best way to give the most efficient effect to that plan. And that's underway. I could also perhaps indicate that it, for this initiative, as with others, we do enjoy a lot of support from our shareholder in pursuing this initiative. With regard to just again on the matter of SMMEs and encouraging the establishment and growth of smaller businesses, especially young businesses. I'd like Alison perhaps to just share with the committee a little bit more around what we're doing on the supplier relations management in that area. As I said, there were a number of questions related to, of clarification related to the black foreign employment and the professionals and the training related to that. And Bo, if you could speak to that. There was a question with regard to the decrease in the BEE spend. Perhaps just to highlight that the first slide was the average for the previous financial year. The second slide was just the year-to-date performance for the first quarter. But Alison could provide a little bit more detail on that. Let me also just indicate that we do believe that, and it is our objective, to improve on our BEE accreditation rating. We have a special initiative around that. Mr. Khololo, your question regarding the disability policy and why it has taken so long. Unfortunately, I cannot give you the detailed answer. Maybe Mbo could assist. But let me again indicate that with the CEO's focus on people with disabilities also enjoying special attention from the CEO and from the board side. I think Mr. Sonto had also raised the question with regard to the cleanup project, both with reference to prevalence and the time that is taken. Mr. Sonto, I think what should be said is this initiative commenced late last year. A lot of work had already been conducted, but we are aware of the fact that we haven't covered the full spectrum yet. And it is our intent to, as far as possible, complete the cleanup by the end of this financial year, insofar as we want to ensure that we're fully compliant. So a lot of work had already been done, but as we sit here, I cannot say to you that we are already complete. And that is why we're also doing this audit, to establish exactly how far we've progressed in the regularization of those irregularities.
By the sense of debt that you are mentioning there, don't you have an idea of how long will this take? Because it practically means that there's a lot of rot there that this project is dealing with.
Chair, I think we need to be cautious to jump to conclusions. I think what I would impress the committee to take comfort in is that an extensive audit is being undertaken to establish what remains to be done. And that is enjoying urgent attention with the intent that we will be compliant by the end of the financial year. But it would be a mistake to read into our disclosure that we are conducting an audit on what remains to be done as an acknowledgement that, the problem is very deep and broad. That is not the case. I would be disappointed if that's read into our report.
No, but it's asking the lifespan.
As I've indicated, we will be closing that project by the end of this financial year, which is end of March, if not before.
It's just on a point of clarity about something you have said, and it was about SAA technical, about how you want to establish it as a hub. Can I, and I don't want to read something into that, but can I then take that you're not wanting to sell it anymore?
In fact, no.
Because you were trying to establish it, I mean, and to spend a lot of money on something that you are selling would be not a good idea.
So, can I raise you up? We've asked this question to the chairperson.
and we have found, it might be my mistake that I did not feedback to the committee. They have categorically assured me, and I think I should have communicated this to the committee, that they are not selling technical, SAA technical, because we had complained that they can't sell the jewel in their stable. Mm. So it's not being sold as far as we know.
According to Marie, when they've advertised for somebody to buy it.
Well, legally that advertisement has not been withdrawn, and that is a risk. Because if I had applied, I would take you to court if you are. So we have the, what I said to the chairperson when they communicated that they are not selling, I said we are watching the space to see whether they are going to withdraw that advertisement. So that is a risk that is flashing red lights. Let's leave it here. They are not selling. That's what I have on record in communication between myself and the chairperson of the board. Please proceed, Sandra.
Chair, you raised the question regarding procurement, the extent to which we procure from other SOEs. Again, other SOEs precluded from tendering to provide services to us, and obviously we would be keen to award tenders to other SOEs, but then satisfying the requirements of the Constitution in terms of fair and equitable competition for our tenders. However, again, if I could remind the committee that keep in mind the type of suppliers that we have. I've noted the Transnet example, and we will certainly follow up on that. At this point in time, the on-flight entertainment and communication system is usually equipped by the supplier of the aircraft also to ensure, well, for the purposes of airworthiness, etc., etc. All of this is actually checked as part of that, but your point is noted and we'll take that forward. There was the question regarding the regulatory environment with regard to procurement. I've raised with you some of the constraints that we do experience in terms of the National Industrial Participation Program, the NIP. However, no, we don't think that complying with the PFMA is necessarily constraining. We are looking, as part of our review of our procurement processes, we are looking at improving our interpretation of the PFMA to still allow the agility to procure efficiently and effectively. But no, we don't necessarily believe that the PFMA is unnecessarily constraining. The Chair's comment with regard to the headcount and the age distribution is noted, and perhaps the Board would also like to comment on that, and our recruitment strategy is commensurate with that. And then we have noted the comments with regard to the public announcement for people with hearing disabilities. Staff have in the past actually the crew would assist passengers as far as that is concerned. It's we do have crew that speak more than one language. Sign language is the one that you've raised, but certainly your comments are taken aboard, and as much as we can extend that service, we will do so. Chair, I think it's important that I perhaps just give Ball to amplify on the HR question, and if Alison could perhaps just share a little bit more on the supplier relations management.
Just before that, I'm going to ask the committee to allow me to leave. I have a meeting with the chief of that starts at 1, and he's my boss. If I'm late, it looks ugly and I walk slowly. I will ask Mr. Ajay to chair and close the meeting. I want to thank from my side as productive engagement. Yeah, the second leg of the meeting that Ms. Ajay will chair will be the adoption of the program. Yes. But if that meeting is short enough, I will come back for the purpose. So our meeting will end with SAA, but we will sit down for 10 minutes or so to do the program. I want to thank SAA and members for a very productive meeting. We are becoming experts in your field because of your presentation, and we will write to you in terms of the meetings we said we need to and propose dates, but we will engage members also in terms of those dates before we send you the letter. That's why I said maybe we'll take 5 working days to remind you of the issues we need to talk about in the future that we agreed on today. Thank you very much. I need a bad handler. I know it's not part of the job. Thanks, bye.
Bye.
Folks, I think in terms of the time factor, it's almost 1 o'clock. I think we can't have two meetings. Hello? We have a problem with time, so I suggest we try and be succinct in our replies and whatever questions remain. I don't think we should take any more questions. Let's just get on with the replies and then break for lunch, and the committee will stay behind for 10 minutes so that we can adopt the rest of the program. The replies that we are waiting for, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start off first with just addressing the issue of the numbers, foreign versus white, foreign employees versus white. And say that that number, the whole slant of the presentation as we've presented it, was really based on the transformation that was required. And as such, the layout of the presentation follows what the Employment Equity Act would require, and that's how it gets reported. But for all intents and purposes, all of those 865 people are not all white, but there are people that are working outside of South Africa. We have stations all over in Africa and in Europe. And that reflects that contingent of people that work in our stations outside the country. On the apprentice program, there was a question about whether we train foreign nationals. The answer to that is yes, and the reason for that is that we fly into a number of countries in Africa, and therefore our maintenance in those countries, our maintenance is multifold, and one of them is what we call line maintenance, and that's maintenance of the aircraft that are flying. And every time we land and take off, we need a technician to have worked on the aircraft. So we do train those people to the countries where we fly, but we also do train people on a request basis. Some of the limitations we have are limitations because the training, not every technician can work on any aircraft. You get licensed to work on a specific aircraft. So to the extent that we don't fly that aircraft, we have not developed the capability to train technicians for the aircraft that we don't fly, unless it's an organization that owns aircraft that we serve, because we do have what we call third party maintenance, which is aircraft that don't belong to us. And I think that covers the training on the SADC region, where the limitations are because we, at the moment, our capability is related to the aircraft that we fly and aircraft that we work on a third-party basis.
just before you carry on the question of the training, you talk about the technical training. What about training of some of the ground staff? I've encountered a lot of difficulties on the Lagos route, where they're not familiar with the Voyager program, and they don't put your miles on, and they're very difficult. You can't, discuss any issue with them. They are SAA personnel. So do we actually train them?
Yes, the training of staff, especially training of cabin crew, is training that is periodic. So after a certain number of flight hours, they must come back into training, largely because of the requirement, the legal requirement in terms of retraining of staff from a safety perspective. But in that is then training that relates to the product that we have and the ability to talk to passengers about the different products that we have, including Voyager. But I'll take that point and see whether there are problems on that side.
No, it's not just a question of clarity.
Yeah.
Of what you just said, that these white foreigners are not all white, that there might be black people between them, and that would skew your targets, if I'm correct. And if that is the case, then you might be underrepresented by white people in the SAA. And people that are saying, well, there are too many whites in the company, might be wrong. Because then we would want to see what the real figures are. I mean, you can't just lump other with white and then have a big group and it looks skewed.
Your comment as to our improvement on the presentation of the slide still remains. The slide was prepared more on an exclusionary basis. In other words, we focus on providing detail in relation to the requirements of black economic empowerment in the different categories, and we group the rest almost together. And so this is how your point with regard to the improvement of the presentation in that regard remains. But just to underscore that point.
So, Madam Chair, I think there were two questions actually specifically. One was the reduction in the black empowerment spend from the whole of last year and the first quarter of this year. Two factors that can drive that. Either is your mix of spend by supplier or the absolute rating and obviously the accreditation that goes with that particular spend. So I think one of the key things we want to do as part of our initiative to better use the SAP system and look at our vendor database, and is obviously to track those in a more proactive manner then so we can actually improve the spend. But I think, the seasonality obviously can play a part in that. I think just moving on to the development of our SME population, as Sandra's already indicated, what we're also looking at is not only just in terms of our assessment of suppliers before we appoint them and the due diligence there, but also then proactive sort of relationships with our suppliers then in terms of what KPIs or key performance indicators we set at the beginning of the contract. And the beauty of that is it's not a stick, it's actually more an encouragement then to say how do we actually make sure that suppliers can actually perform the job, but also then how we can obviously improve that service over time. And that then stands regardless of obviously the contract length that we go into, is that at the end of that is that those suppliers actually have got a demonstrable track record with us and hopefully a very good one that can only then bode well for the future. So again, that's a very powerful initiative then to say how do we set up those relationships. So I hope that's answered that question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to stop here. There was a question that we need some answers. Some of them we have, some of them we will attend to. First of all, I want to thank all of you for the very, very comprehensive and I think a very difficult one at times. Your input and replies, we will welcome back in the future. And we hope to see you soon. And with that,
to the time limit on when we get the answer to the question.
Well, we can't answer for them because we're going to put in a question to them and then we'll put them to the time limit.
To seek clarification from our side as well. Our understanding is that we will receive an indication of matter to be briefed on as a further opportunity. If our measures indicated within the committee, also there is a number of these initiatives we are currently working on, so that we have a realistic time frame by which we can, in relation to some of them, come back to really comprehensively rather than piecemeal. So if we do have the liberty of engaging with you, that's too fine. We are ready with this now, we're ready with that now, and not do it as a comprehensive reading of all of those accolades at the same time. We've really just appreciate your intelligence.
This is the last thing. In terms of the black-white component, foreign component of what you, we need really a breakdown. Where are they actually situated? What kind of work they do and that kind of thing. So we really need a more comprehensive breakdown as to that component. And with that,
in terms of our program, we're only 6 people here. I'm not quite sure whether we have the mandate to actually adopt the program.
I think we're not correct. I think let's postpone it. The adoption should not be questionable.
Yeah.
Let's prioritize it
at a
properly correct meeting.
Okay, fine. So the Alex
call
report and the
program
will be
postponed.
Thank you.
Postponed.
Left here thing here.
No,
media people.
Media
people. Someone left. Why is he in the end of the room?
I think they see a little bit.
I don't know.
This
belongs to the media.
I think the BMG woman.
I was going to get a tank. That'd be great.